We can't include that in the episode, but yeah, we'll start from there. Yeah. Sweet.
All right, Sound. Welcome to a new episode of the Ball Chat Sports Podcast. I'm joined by James Allen and Liam Flynn. We're going to go over the quick episode summary. So we've got some Champions League review. We've got a Prem roundup. We have an England squad announcement that I am going to care about because it's for the friendlies, not even for the qualifiers. And then Jim's going to go over the featured fights, including an unbelievable Conlon versus Wood fight, which is definitely going to go down as one of the fights of the year. And a preview of the weekend's action to come. And just an honourable mention to March Madness, which kicks off today, and Cheltenham Festival, our boys' favourite pastime.
Yeah, Pizzy in his tartan suit. What a treat that was on Instagram. I didn't even realise he was going in like that for Cheltenham. I haven't watched a single race, and I'm alarmed at how often my surname is coming up in all the naming of these horses. So, conspiracy, perhaps. I'm not sure, though.
Well, Pizzy's in a suit.
Have you not seen him?
Nah.
Mate, he's fucking Braveheart in a pale blue number, man. He looks like they've all gone in, like actually dressed up.
I can't picture
it,
man. I actually cannot picture Pizzy in a suit, so I need to go and check this out.
Mate, he's still wearing his Gaelic top underneath, but it's a nice suit, though.
Who's all gone down there?
I think Stitch, Pizzy, and there was two other people in the photo that I didn't recognise, but they look like they've actually gone in. And young Jack Allen, my little brother, he won, I think he was like 40-1 today. So he's like got 100 and something quid off a proper meager little bet. So fair play to him. All the lads are going in. I think Big Red's down. Ben Pritchard's down. Not to air out your betting dirty laundry, lads. But yeah, not everyone's having a good time.
That's what, 50% of our listenership? Shout out to them.
Yeah, all the gamblers. I actually haven't had a single bet. I don't know what it is, but when I'm over here, I don't know if it's the timing of stuff, but like, I just don't feel like compelled to have a bet. Whereas like if I was back like home, even if I was working, like, you know what I mean? If I was busy, I'd still be like on my phone looking at like the horses and seeing what I'm going to have a bet on. But I just couldn't give a fuck like this time. Yeah, I don't know why.
It's because Pat Bissett, and actually to be fair, Deb Bissett as well, don't come in like, oh, the race starts in 2 minutes. And you're like, yeah, I'll have 20 quid on this. Like, it's relentless, man, to be fair.
Or it's my dad will come up to my computer and just be like, not poke his head in, be like, can you check these results, please? Can you just tally that up for me? For fuck's sake.
You love it, man. You know, I've never seen you so alive as when you do some gambling with Pat.
I do. Not going to lie. That's the only thing we've ever connected on in the last, like, 16 years is gambling, so. You know what I mean?
And that's how you know you don't listen to the podcast, straight up. You're getting in those digs.
So let's kick off the preamble ramble with what's going on with Chelsea Football Club, an unprecedented moment in British football club history. Let's talk about what the ramifications for the club might be and how long it will take them to get back to normality. Do you really think it's on that level? Do you think we're talking like the club's going to really suffer from what's been happening with them?
So what are the restrictions that have been placed on them? I know they had to close the merchandise shop, which must have been a really heavy hit to their coffers, but they're not allowed to sell players, are they? They're not allowed to... They're basically frozen out of the transfer market. Is that correct?
I think their assets have been frozen. Any income is going to be frozen. So they can't make any profit off anything sold in the club shop. Obviously, that's closed. They can't even sell tickets, I noticed. So there was a... You know, I think they got an FA Cup game against Middlesbrough coming up. I don't know if it's this weekend or the weekend after next. But... They're not even allowed to sell tickets for that, even though, like away tickets, even though the money would be going to Middlesbrough, they're not allowed to have any tickets sold in that game. So literally, I think the government taking a little bit too far. You know, obviously, it's kind of like one rule for one rule for, it can't be one rule for one rule for another. So I think that's why the government have chose to, you know, go after all the sort of Russian oligarchs, like in light of what's happening in Ukraine. And obviously the book can't stop at Abramovich, so his assets have to be, you know, frozen as well. I just think that because Chelsea, it's more of like a community asset, isn't it? What are your thoughts on this? Do you think this is something that should be happening? Because personally, I think it's a bit unfair, really, to the Chelsea support.
Well, unfair to the Chelsea support. Should it be happening? I think you nailed it earlier. It can't be one rule for someone, different rule for the next. And then there's always, I suppose there's always a chance of some of that money ending up buying weapons for the Russian military effort. Not saying that's the case, but you just never know. But I've been reading a lot today that they're talking about selling it, and they've got apparently about 30 different buyers making bids for it. Have you heard about this?
Yeah, and this, you know, and this brings me on to the point that Premier League have apparently been mulling over implementing a human rights consideration in their fit and proper persons tests, which actually makes me laugh out loud, considering that the Saudi government have been basically bought Newcastle. And one of the owners, one of the prospective owners for the sale of Chelsea Football Club, is also somebody, I think, from Qatar or one of the other nations that have got horrible human rights issues. And there was somebody the other day, I think it was Eddie Howe, that had to answer a question coming from a journalist in their press conference. He was asked, what do you think about today being the largest number of beheadings in Saudi Arabia for the calendar year, or for something like that, in the last 265 days? It was like 81 beheadings in one day. And he was just like, I'm just going to stick to the football. You know what I mean? That kind of thing. Obviously, like, how are you meant to answer that as a coach, a head coach of a football team? How are you going to answer a question like that?
Do we need his opinion on that?
Like, yeah, are we going to be better off? What are we going to learn from that? Do you know what I mean? He's not like head of state, is he?
That is quite a lot of beheadings, though, isn't it? To be fair. Look, your question, I think it starts on a premise where, like, I'd like to go back a little bit from there. I'm not sure if it's even fair for Russian individuals, albeit extremely wealthy Russian individuals, to be punished for the decisions their governments are making. I'm really not sure if that's fair. And, you know, the issue of Chelsea being a community asset as well as a private business, like, a lot of people are being punished for something they've got nothing to do with. So I'm not sure if I agree with Abramovich being punished at all, to be honest. I certainly don't agree with the club, the players, the staff, the fans, all being punished for a fucking dick swinging contest. I don't think it's very fair.
And there was something that Jordan Peterson, praise be, brought up in one of his podcasts with Joe Rogan. And it was the term, I'm not exactly sure what the term was, but it was basically something along the lines of identity politics, like culpability based on the group that you're, you know, assigning you into a group and saying that you're all culpable because you're all Russian. You're all culpable because you're a certain race. Do you know what I mean? And there's massive, massive issues with that. And I do feel that it's becoming a little bit like that. Oh, you're Russian and you're rich and you're living in Britain. Even though Abramovich has been living in Britain for, what, 20 years now? Is it? How long has he been the owner of Chelsea? Like, is it coming up to about 20 years?
2003, I think he bought the club.
Okay, yeah, man. So yeah, Nick, coming up to 2 years, 20 years. And, you know, there's never been any sort of, I've never heard of any him being pally-pally with Putin. I don't know how far his friendship goes with Putin, but should he be taking the rack for what he's doing in Ukraine? Like, should we be putting every Russian person into the same category? I'd say absolutely not, man.
Definitely not. Shouldn't be putting them all in the same category. But I think, now that I'm super well read up on it, that Abramovich does have some sort of history with Putin. Something to do with the fact that he is so affluent. There was something to do with him and Putin back in the 80s.
Yeah, I think it was something to do with the oil companies that they owned. Maybe he had a bit of, like, you know, sort of like help. Well, definitely had some sort of help because he's a fucking billionaire, isn't he? So...
That's going to happen between heads of state and wealthy people. That's like, like these big events, there's probably hundreds of people there, you know, all with their various entourages. For it could be a charity event, it could be a public event, it could be a government event. You are, like, the billionaires in this country mingle with the politicians. Like, it's just standard. Like, I'm not privy to his interactions with Putin. It could be their best mates and he's completely like a villain, but I don't know. And I haven't seen any evidence that suggests he actually is. And the only evidence against him is the fact that he's Russian. Like, it's seeping into everything now, even silly things. Like, well, not silly for me, it's not my job, but like, people on Strictly Come Dancing and that, like, the Russians on there, they're going like publicly denounce what's going on, or you like can get off the show. It's like, what is this, man? Like, aren't we all supposed to give people the benefit of the doubt? And aren't we supposed to view people as people rather than their nationalities or their gender or their sexuality or their race? Like, what's going on? This is like uncovering like a deep hypocritical streak in just the general media, man. It's as soon as you're on the wrong side, i.e. the other side of the Cold War divide from like the 80s, that shit was supposed to have ended like decades ago. As soon as you're over there and deemed to be the enemy, then, you know, you have to abide by unfair rules. It's, yeah, the more we talk about it, the more it's quite unseemly, isn't it? The way it's leeching into everything.
Yeah, 100%. And obviously Chelsea are apparently, like, you know, sort of week to week in terms of their finances. They can't inject any cash unless the club's been sold. So the longer this goes on and the longer we don't have a new owner in place, they're going to be struggling to meet, you know, their wage bill, because obviously they're going to have a huge wage bill. So, you know, the majority of the money and the cash flow is going to be sort of, you know, it's going to go through that. They're going to have to pay their players. So they have to pay their staff. And to be honest, it will be the staff that they're the ones that are going to lose their jobs first. You know what I mean? So like we saw with, who was it? Well, most football clubs that find themselves in financial trouble, usually it's the staff that get cut first. So I'm not sure how far this is going to go, whether Chelsea are going to start to, you know, see a reflection in their sort of performances on the field. We haven't seen that yet. There are players that are out of contract in the summer. And if there hasn't been a resolution by then, players like Antonio Rudiger, who will need a new contract in the summer, you know, if he's out of contract, he's going to go somewhere else, isn't he? If there's still financial sort of question marks over Chelsea, like, you know, you're probably going to go, all right, I can probably get, you know, the same wage, if not more, somewhere else. I'm not going to stay here when I'm not sure whether I'm going to get, you know, paid every month. Do you know what I mean? So the problems at Chelsea, they need to be resolved quickly for the benefit of the club and benefit of the supporters, really.
Do you think it could lead to some sort of like brain drain? All the top key figures of Chelsea leaking out somewhere else because they're actually going to get paid.
It's an interesting point, really, isn't it? It's hard to say what would happen in this situation because it's the first time we've ever seen it. It is unprecedented. We've never known a football club's assets to be frozen by the government. So it's a first. So it'd be really interesting. I think this sale of the club needs to go through ASAP. To make sure that the Chelsea can continue running, because we don't want to see one of our nation's big clubs, you know, struggle this way, do we really?
Newcastle are going to be absolutely buzzing, man. They're going to be waiting there with 50% markups on contracts for everyone. They're going to be in the Champions League next season, man, guaranteed.
Out of the frying pan into the fire, innit? Do you know what I mean? With those owners as well. That made me laugh, that human rights. Fucking hell, yeah. All right, we'll move on to the Champions League, innit? And we'll talk about PSG and Real Madrid and what a game this was. It feels like months ago this, even though it was only last week. Benzema had a 17-minute hat-trick, turned the tie on its head. PSG self-imploding again. The elusive Champions League trophy evades them yet again. And you have to question, well, I would question their bottle, their game management, the culture of the club, whatever it is you want to call it that gets teams over the line. The Fergie fabric that you need in big European nights. But the team, you know, obviously they've been fueled by Qatari oil money for a long time now. I say long time, for quite a few years. Is it just the fact that they just haven't got it in their DNA to be able to win this trophy?
Well, they certainly haven't got that European legacy that you talk about. I think it's a very difficult thing to buy your way to a Champions League. Definitely. I mean, I said a couple of weeks ago, they're not even smashing it in their own league. And then when I looked, the points deficit at the top is quite large, but they're not this untouchable force, even in a lopsided league like Ligue 1. So when it comes to beating like established teams, like they're like Real Madrid aren't even like half the team they were a couple of years ago. And what do you think Bayern Munich would do to PSG? I think they've got a lot of ground to make up in terms of where they go, especially when you consider Messi's age. A lot of people question Neymar's dedication. Mbappe is probably off sometime soon. He's like a bright spark in that team. Di Maria's playing pretty well. What's your man's name who signed in the summer? Is it Hakimi?
Yeah, he's one of the fullbacks. I mean, he's the right back.
So it's not as if... And the keeper as well, your boy, Donnarumma.
Yeah, so they seem to rotate him and I think it's Keylor Navas. I think Donnarumma seems to be playing the Champions League games. And then whenever I look, when they got a league game, it seems to be Keylor Navas in goal. I think
it's a bit iffy, isn't it?
It is a bit iffy, but I obviously Pochettino, you know, we can't really question his management style. I think he has been relatively successful in his time as a coach so far. But I really think PSG, they've got these superstars up front. Obviously, the ones you just mentioned, Neymar, Messi, and Mbappe, who looks like he will be going to Real Madrid probably in the summer. But I think when you come up against good teams in Europe, and they look like they were cruising at 2-0 up on aggregate in the second half. But those three players, you wouldn't exactly say any of them are going to track back and help out the midfield. So do you think that by playing those three in a big Champions League away game at Real Madrid, like, could they have perhaps been a little bit more pragmatic? Could Poch maybe have said, like, look, maybe I'll play somebody that's going to, you know, I don't know who they'd put there, but maybe someone that would be more willing to trap back and help out defensively when they need it. Could he have perhaps, when they went 2-0 up or at halftime, could he have brought off one of them? But is there a player power there between those three where, like, if they did get taken off, it would be like, you know, sort of he'd be causing a fracas in the dressing room or what?
Listen, this is the double-edged sword of signing someone like Messi, a living legend, basically. That's, I don't even think that's an overstatement. Are you really going to have a Champions League tie against Real Madrid and not play Messi? Really? Like, it's not going to happen, is it? Not if he's fit and raring to go. Are you going to not play Mbappe when he's like, he's the next superstar coming through? Not going to happen. I mean, Neymar probably does get rotated a fair bit. I mean, especially he's a bit injury prone and that, and he loves a tequila, doesn't he? Fair play to him. But yeah, I think you make a fair point there. Those lads aren't going to track back. And Pochettino, I don't think as good of a manager as he's proven himself to be. I think there's a larger demand at the club to play those commercially viable players. And I think he's caught between a rock and a hard place in that sense.
I think Marquinhos, their Brazilian centre-back, who was only 27, I thought he was much older, but he's made a lot of appearances for PSG. And he was at fault for at least two of those Benzema goals in the second half. And then you start to look, well, who are the, you know, who are the problems in the team? Who are the consistent, you know, bad performers in the Champions League? And the people, the players that have been there for a while that perhaps, you know, you're starting to think, right, who do we look at? Who are we going to try and change in the future? Do we need to get a more experienced centre-back in? Do we need to get, you know, a high-quality central midfielder? They have got good players throughout the squad. But once again, it comes down to how many leaders have they got? How many players have they got experienced in the Champions League and that have been there and done it? Obviously, they brought in Messi. They got the attacking players that have done it. Neymar, who I still think is probably one of the most overrated players I've ever seen, like in terms of like the way people speak about him or have spoke about him and his consistency. I don't think it have been there, you know, historically. And then obviously you brought it up about Michael Richards talking about quality. What did he say about Benzema?
He said he's finally proven himself. I mean, come on. Our hot takes are some of the worst you'll ever hear, but he has pulled a Katie Couric straight out of his arse there, man. That is terrible. Karim Benzema, he was scoring against United back in 2009. He's been like, I'm pretty sure he's the all-time top French goal scorer. Like, fuck is he talking about?
He's consistently been like, probably in the top 10 strikers in the world for the last 10 years, at least. And he's consistently been one of the best strikers in the world. But then Michael Richards was like, oh, he's finally brought himself onto the, world stage.
He's won me over. Karim Benzema has won you over. Come on.
Stats are incredible. I'm looking at them now. 2021, top goal scorer in the European Championship. 21 to 22 Champions League top goal scorer, La Liga 21-22. the list is endless, mate. It goes back years. He's killing it.
And he's past his peak. Like, he's probably 2 or 3 years past his peak. He's been smashing it for years, man. Richards, man. I like him, to be fair, but he's dropped the Katie Couric there, man, for sure.
He's finally impressed your boy Richards.
And what is he? He's like 34, 35. I think it's quite interesting, really, with obviously Lewandowski, who's gonna win the Ballon d'Or this year, 100%. He's top goal scorer in the Champions League already. And he's like, his goal scoring form over the last sort of 24 months has been absolutely incredible. He's 36. Benzema's, you know, in his mid-30s. You know, historically, we said strikers peak at like 26, 27, 28. That's the sort of peak years. But I don't know. I don't know if it's whether strikes have been changed in terms of, like, you know, they're fitter now, like they stay quicker for longer, or they just, the games become more tactical. So, you know, they're using more of their mental attributes, their awareness, their, you know, their perceptions on the field. So being in the right place at the right time, their instinct in the box. But strikers seem to be, you know, doing the older strikers, the sort of past the 30 seem to be, you know, the world's top strikers at the minute. Obviously, Harry Kane's, what, 28, 29. So it's gone to the days of like Michael Owen and sort of being like 22 and being the world's best striker. You know, I think we've evolved from that. Obviously, Mbappe, he's got the pace, but he's not quite, I don't know. Yeah, he's probably one of the top strikers. But yeah, it's quite interesting to see, like, you know, top level strikers in their sort of like mid 30s still performing at the highest level, isn't it?
Systems have changed as well, though. We spoke a lot about that false nine being implemented. Like, those players have got a lot more attacking support than they would have had back in the day, where they're like peeling off the last defender, and that, where pace was probably a bit more integral than it is now. Now, a lot of the times you'll see these strikers are one of about four or five attacking players in the box. And because their instincts are so much sharper than everyone else's, and because the defenders are preoccupied, they're getting those opportunities. So yeah, I'd say that the game, at least in Europe anyway, is changing to add a few years onto a few careers, which is great, you know, because these are top level strikers.
Yeah, and because, like, I'd say like 10 years ago, there might be more emphasis on putting the ball over the top for a young, pacey striker to run onto and finish one-on-one. Whereas, as you say, maybe it's more about movement in the box now. A lot of teams sit deep and play a bit more tactical, play a low block. So you need that sort of like nous in the box to be able to make that movement at the right time. So yeah, I think that probably contributes to it. But we'll move on to Ajax, our boys. They got knocked out the Champions League. Benfica, aggregate win 3-2. Onana, the keeper, misjudging a flight cross, resulting in the game decided goal in the 77th minute. Second top goal scorer, Sebastian Haller, who we spoke about quite a lot in this podcast. He crashes out of the tournament. He scored 10 for Ajax. Obviously, Lewandowski leads on 12. And Benfica reached the final 8 in the Champions League for the first time in 6 years. Ajax now have gone 26-year winless streak at home. I haven't actually double-checked this, but I saw this stat the other day. Maybe Flynn can quickly check it. In the knockout rounds of the Champions League. So they haven't won a knockout round home game in the Champions League for 26 years. Bit nuts, that. Well,
they got to the semi-finals against Spurs a few years ago. Maybe they drew at home. I don't know, but I find that quite hard to believe that they haven't won a home tie in Europe for that long.
Yeah, and it's interesting to see Streets Won't Forget, Adel Taarabt will be featuring in a Champions League quarter final for the first time.
Looks like you might be right. Ajax couldn't hold a 26-year winless streak at home in the knockout rounds of the European competition on Tuesday by losing 1-0 to Benfica. Wow.
Pretty balmy, that, isn't it? But as Jim was saying in the group the other day, it was like, these stats are just becoming more and more West. Like, you know what I mean?
It's
like,
definitely are.
How do we get the wow factor from a stat? Oh, this is the first time Harry Maguire, like, hasn't conceded when, like, a player called Brian's been on the pitch. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's just like, where do we go from here with these stats?
Yeah, Lukaku hasn't took this few touches in the box since the last full moon. One of those type of things, man. It is ridiculous. Like, I seen, they got one of those infographics up in the Sky Sports studio the other day, basically illustrating how bad Man United have been. And I just thought, you're reaching for the stars, man. S Club 7 style. I was thinking, absolutely ridiculous. I wish I could remember the example, but I was just thinking, this is a waste of their time and ours, man. So, interesting about Haller as well. He had a goal disallowed in, I think it was the first half. Nice bit of movement from Ajax. So they could have been onto a winner there. And from what the highlights suggested, that game was a bit of a dud overall, which is not what you want to see from our flagship team here on the podcast.
Yeah, very unfortunate they weren't able to progress. And another team, as you just mentioned, that weren't able to progress was Man United. And I'd say fairly noticeable boos at the full-time whistle. United crash out at the round of 16. Jan Oblak was in fine form, to be fair, in the Atletico goal, probably the best keeper in the world at the moment. And not for the first time, under Ranić this season, United failed to create enough clear-cut chances to win a game of football. I think they have struggled, really, to score goals since Ranić's gone in there. And I think team selection, once again, will come under criticism. Game management in terms of substitutions and tactical shifts. I think he kind of, like, went for broke he was like, all right, we're losing. Last sort of like 20, 25 minutes, he was like, let's throw on all the attacking players, which doesn't strike me as being a sort of modern day approach to the game from a managerial perspective. Usually it's like, we're going to stick to our philosophy. We're going to stick to our tactics and they're going to come good. But he didn't do that. What do you make of Harry Maguire being subbed off? Who's the, you know, he's the captain, he's the club captain, which was cheered by a large proportion of the Old Trafford crowd. And the man that came on for him was Juan Mata, who I think made his third appearance of the season. I don't think he's made a single appearance in the Premier League this season. It was only the third time he's come off the bench or something. So he's barely played. And he just threw on Juan Mata that didn't, it made absolutely no sense to me at all. So unfortunate for Wreck-It Ralph.
I did see that Harry Maguire was pulling out some shocking clearances, like just handing the ball back to, I forgot they were playing that, back to Atletico. And so Harry Maguire just kept giving the ball away willy-nilly to Atletico. And I'm not surprised the United fans were booing him, because as I think we were right to praise Harry Maguire in the Euros. And I can't honestly say that I watch enough United games full stop to say how he's been consistently over the season. You've certainly had specific examples of where he's been subpar in a Man United shirt and as a Man United captain. I'm surprised on that level that he was subbed off because he's captain and that. I didn't realise Juan Mata was still at United or was still even an active footballer. So to have that kind of... I mean, what would Juan... He's got to be 45 years old, Juan Mata, isn't he? Like, what is he going to bring to the table that other more dynamic attacking players aren't going to bring, you know? I mean, it is a bit strange.
It felt a bit embarrassing, I think, to take your captain off for a player that's barely played. And, you know, I wonder, was it a bit of shithousery from Ranić? Like, did he want Maguire to feel, I don't know, belittling him a little bit? I think it was a poor decision. Like, in terms of man management, I think he could have maybe perhaps taken off. It probably would have been Varane, would have been the other centre back, because I think Lindelof was on the bench. Obviously, there's other players he could have shifted formation. He brought on Edison Cavani as well, so it was kind of like, and I think Rashford came on, who was coming for a lot of criticism as well. So it's just not really looking good at all for United at the minute, and it's looking like almost certainly that Ranić's going to leave at the end of the season. Perhaps Ten Hag, and now Ajax have been knocked out. It's going to be Ten Hag or Pochettino, you'd have to imagine, wouldn't you?
Yeah, but that's the thing, man. Like, if Ajax and United go out at the same stage in the Champions League, why is everyone so sure that Ten Hag is the man for the job? He's the name. Like, he looks like he's like nailed on favourite to get the job now. Why is he a more favourable option than Ranić?
It's difficult to answer. I don't think the problems lie solely at the managerial position. I think, you know, we spoke about the poor recruitment at United. I think that needs to be addressed first. I think there's problems outside the dressing room, really. I think, obviously, there's problems with the players there at the club at the minute. I think there's certain personalities that probably need to leave. I think there's players like Rashford, perhaps he will do a much better job going somewhere else in the Premier League, maybe to another sort of, you know, top six club. I think he'd probably flourish. I think he needs a change of scenery, perhaps. Jadon Sancho hasn't quite lived up to the sort of promise that was expected of him when he arrived. Paul Pogba has not been good for how long now? 18 months?
Sancho nearly scored the other night, man. And it's funny you say that they didn't create enough chances, because I got the impression, only from the highlights again, admittedly, that they were creating quite a lot, but there was just that final cutting edge bit of play that they were missing. They were getting the ball forward plenty, and it seemed like there was quite a few near misses. And I was thinking to myself, like, Man U fans, I mean, apart from Harry Maguire, I'm not even saying that to twist a knife, but he did stand out as someone who was seemed to be performing quite poorly. I'd be thinking, you can kind of take heart from this. Atletico are a good, solid European standard team. They've won it in the last, like, however many years. They're always competing since Simeone's been at the helm for La Liga. Like, that's not a bad result, really, especially if you're a club that's been in quote-unquote crisis for the better part of a decade. So, I don't know, man. It's not the worst result in the world.
once again, it's going to be a difficult sell for United fans because there is so much expectation around the club. And I think the fans, I don't know, do they expect Manchester United to get, you know, guaranteed to get into a quarterfinal or a semi-final in Champions League? Is that what Man United fans expect right now? It's difficult to say, isn't it?
Did you see the Man U fans dashing bottles at Simeone?
Yeah. Legends.
Yeah, he didn't even stay to shake hands. He just dashed into the tunnel.
He was probably giving it a bigger though, wasn't he, throughout the game? I don't know.
He always runs to the changing room, man. Like, all the time. I think that is a bizarre way to finish a game. Everyone else stays, kind of chills a bit, and he just sprints, like, to the changing room.
All right, so we'll move on to the Chelsea game. So they completed a comfortable two-game tie over last year's French champions Lille. Goals from Christian Pulisic and Azpilicueta cemented a 2-1 victory on the night, adding to the 2-0 win a fortnight ago. Once again, no room for Lukaku in the starting lineup. Tuchel opted to go for Kai Havertz and Pulisic as his men up top. Remarkably, his record with Chelsea in the Champions League, you know, he's been in charge for what, just over a year now. He's managed to bring in a Champions League trophy and is already well on his way to achieving another. And with all the problems they're experiencing off the field, they continue to impress with their performances on it. He's now only lost 9 games out of 78 as Chelsea manager with a 64.1% win rate. I would say there's not many coaches in the history of the Premier League that can boast a win percentage as high as that with 50 games or more. I think he's doing a fantastic job. And even his German pal, Jürgen, can't boast a win rate that high, but Pep Guardiola can.
It's about that focus, isn't it? Like, whatever's going on off the pitch, they need to be applauded for maintaining their focus on an elite competition. It's like, I don't know if you saw in the United game where Harry Maguire headbutted Ronaldo and he looked like one of his teeth had fallen out, and all of a sudden the ball came alive and he just switched onto it. He was like a border collie looking for a tennis ball, man. That's the kind of focus and concentration you need at the top level. I just thought that was an interesting little insight into how focused he is. But that's what the Chelsea players are doing. Like, this has got to be in the news every day. It directly affects their wage packet and their income and their future prospects. So for them to keep pulling out results, especially away from home, in that, like, their Lille support, they made it into a cauldron. That couldn't have been an easy place to go. And good performance from them, especially that nice Henry-esque finish from Pulisic. That was really good.
Yeah, I think he's really grew into his own. I'd say over the last, you know, I think when Tuchel first came there, he wasn't really that keen on him, even though they had that connection from Dortmund. He wasn't picking him really. I think it took a few months for him to become a sort of a mainstay. And I'd say that's what he's becoming. I think he's probably, he's got more chance of getting in the starting lineup than Lukaku has at the minute. And obviously, Lukaku had been a completely different player to Havertz and Pulisic, but I think they're fitting the Tuchel and Chelsea mould at the minute, them two players, whereas Lukaku isn't quite connecting with the players as well as Tuchel might imagine. And obviously, Kai Havertz has been, you know, one of the standout players, really, since he's come in as manager. So, no, I think fair play to the Chelsea players, as you intonated towards, Jim, man. I think they've kept their minds focus firmly on the prize, and they go into the last 8, and hopefully they're going to look to Chelsea, maybe look to avoid one of the giants and perhaps get Benfica or Villarreal, who had a great performance against Juventus, beat them 3-0, you know, in Turin. And a good evening from Unai Emery. Do you remember when he was Chelsea manager, Arsenal manager.
Yeah,
good,
yeah.
Evening.
But, you know, that's a cracking result for Villarreal, you know. I mean, I feel like Juve, I think you could liken them to United at the minute in terms of, like, they're floundering in the league. They haven't had much European success. A lot of their marquee signings choose to go elsewhere. And, it capitulated for them in, like, the last, was it 20 minutes of the second half? Yeah. They had quite a few chances in the first half, man. Villarreal stuck to their guns, defended like dogs, man. You know, last minute, like, their keeper had the game of his life and the defenders were smashing it. And I think, was it Coquelin who got brought down? Another former Arsenal midfielder who got brought down for the first penalty. Gerrard stuck that away. One of the defenders got the header or the tap-in from the six-yard box for the second goal? And then another penalty with like 4 minutes to go. So Juve capitulated pretty hard, worse than PSG, I'd say.
Yeah, and that's the third consecutive time that they've been knocked out at this stage of the competition. And obviously, they narrowly made it to the Champions League last year. I think they've had a couple of poor seasons in the Serie A, really. And they currently sit fourth in the Serie A as it stands, 7 points off AC Milan. And I think this result probably reflects just as much as it does badly on Juventus as it does well on Unai Emery and Villarreal. Because they're seventh in the league, Villarreal, in La Liga. They've had really no form in La Liga, but you know, in Europe, he's becoming a bit of a European night specialist, isn't he, Emery? Like, they beat, obviously, Manchester United in the Europa League final, you know, just, what was it, like, just under 12 months ago on penalties. And now they find themselves in the last eight of the Don competition. And, you know, they're going to have a lot of big teams around them. So who, you know, the draw is tomorrow. So will teams be thinking, oh yeah, do fancy Villarreal? Because obviously they're going to be the sort of like by far the outsiders out of those last eight to win it. Or do you think that's a potential like banana skin? Do you think teams want to perhaps avoid them? Because at the end of the day, they're going to have fucking nothing to lose, are they?
You don't really want to play like Real Madrid and Bayern though, do you? You know,
if you've got a choice.
Yeah, you'd definitely be going for like the potential whipping boys. But as you say, Benfica, the way they won against Ajax, you could see they're willing to scrap it out and just like score a little goal and just hold on to that. I think this result for Villarreal was a bit of an anomaly. And I think who else has gone through to the quarterfinals? Let's have a look now. Yeah, you definitely want Villarreal or Benfica. Those are the only ones that stand out as like potential easy quarterfinal draws, but nothing's easy from this stage on, is it? I mean, you underestimate your opponents at your peril in the Champions League. That's been shown time and time again.
All right, so we'll gloss over the Premier League results as well.
Arsenal lost last night to Liverpool.
Should we talk about that?
I didn't even watch the highlights, so it was too painful for me. Everyone's buzzing, so it keeps the title race alive. But I'm thinking, like, Arsenal have been surging lately. I'm fucking dickheads, man. Clough and Liverpool.
But, yeah, let's just talk about that then. Obviously, Arsenal lost 2-0. Was it 2-0? I think two goals in the second half for Liverpool. By and large, obviously, I didn't watch the game. But what I've heard from Twitter, that it was a pretty good performance for Arsenal. And I'm basing this mainly on Piers Morgan's chat, that what he was coming out with. He was saying
fucking frog. Don't listen to him.
But he was saying that it was a pretty impressive performance, even though they lost 2-0. Obviously, I think Liverpool are just one of the hardest teams to play in the world at the minute, along with Man City. But they've cut the title race to just 1 point now after Man City dropped points against Crystal Palace. Was it Monday night in a 0-0 draw?
I'd have to have a look at the City result, but as I was saying, quite disappointed for Arsenal after the recent run of form they've been on. In all fairness, I don't think anyone would have expected them to beat Liverpool, especially in the form that they're in. And I think if you're going to get beat by someone, and it was only 2-0 as well, it may as well be the potential league champions. But, you know, Piers Morgan is going to say that they played really well. I think he's an Arsenal fan. Don't ask me where I've cobbled that from, but I'm pretty sure he is.
Massive, massive Arsenal fan. Well, I say massive. Like, he's always chatting shit, isn't it? About him.
He's like that Simon Jordan, isn't it? Definitely. Yeah. They're like the equivalents, man. I hate them both.
Just a point between Liverpool and Man City now.
Yeah, 1 point. I think they're on the same amount of games now. Oh, yeah, that was it. 40-1. Liverpool were just a week ago to win the quadruple. Obviously, they've already won the Carling Cup. They're now into the quarterfinals of the Champions League. So the odds of that would change depending on who they're going to draw. But now they're only a point behind in the Premier League. That becomes a little bit more even. Then you've got the FA Cup, I think, are we in the quarterfinal stage or semi-final stage of the FA Cup? Quarterfinals it might be. But anyway, so if you would have got on that 40-1 Liverpool, I reckon it's not 40-1 anymore. It's probably going to be half that now. Do you know what I mean? So because they're in contention now for all three of those remaining trophies. Like if you offered 40-1 to people now, they'd probably rip your hand off, man.
There's always the potential for the dominoes to start falling quite rapidly when you're maintaining battles on so many fronts. You know, I mean, it was such an unlikely thing for United to do the treble back in the day. Has an English team done it since?
No, I don't think so. Nah.
The quadruple seems not unthinkable, but quite unlikely, man. A especially when you factor in the Champions League and the league, like the quality of the teams they're going to be competing against. If Liverpool manage to do that, they'll carve out a little niche for themselves in football and history, won't they? So hopefully they can do it just for the stat.
And I think a little bit like Leicester when they won the Premier League, obviously they were only focusing on the Premier League because they wouldn't have been in Europe. And, you know, if you're doing that well in the Premier League, you're not really going to care about the League Cup and the FA Cup. But for Liverpool to be able to compete like in all four of those competitions, and they haven't really had any injuries. And I think that is pivotal, really. If you want to be successful in all four competitions, you need to avoid your key players being injured. And obviously having Van Dijk back this season after he was a huge miss last year. And they've got some pieces around that, the first team that they have now. Obviously, they brought in players like Luis Diaz, who looks like a really good player. They've had Minamino there for a while. That's sort of on the squad fringe players. Diogo Jota is sort of one of those fringe players as well. And Harvey Elliott as well. He's come in. Naby Keita. So they've brought in pretty well over the last 3 years, and all of their sort of transfers have been a sort of a big success, really. You can't really name any players where you thought, it was a bit of a waste of money over the last few years, can you? And I think that's important if you want to compete like in all competitions. You need to have a lot of depth in the squad, don't you?
And think about it, like how few injuries they've had. I would put that down, especially when it comes to Salah and Mane. Like, they're Muslims, aren't it? They don't drink. So they're probably living clean, man. Do you know what I mean? Like, how many other... If there's characters like that within your team and they're achieving at that level, that's quite likely to communicate itself to everyone else, you know? Like, James Milner, I don't think he drinks either. Do you know what I mean? I think there might be quite a, like, what's it called? Like, a bit of a spa vibe going on there. Like, a treat your body as a temple type of thing going on there. Whereas, you know, other players, like... You think like Jack Grealish, man, or like back in the day, Jack Wilshere, all the Jacks up for the session. Like, they suffer fair amounts of injuries, don't they? Because they love a few pints. I would be surprised. I'd want to see
like a correlation there.
Yeah, yeah. I'd like to see like if they could point it down, because obviously alcohol causes inflammation. Inflammation leads to injuries, et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah.
We'll get Flynn on it. We'll get Flynn to do a bit of research and see if there's any correlation between the big drinking footballers and their injuries. Because obviously Ronaldo... Like Cristiano, like he's never drunk. I think he didn't drink because his dad died from alcoholism or something. Do you know? I think he had like liver failure or something due to excessive drinking. So that was kind of like, the catalyst for him, quitting drinking or not starting drinking. I don't know. But I think since he's been at United, I don't think there's been ever been any evidence that he's been a big drinker. So I think a lot of players nowadays, a lot of modern day players, yeah, they have got exceptional diets, and that starts with not, you know, going out for 10 pints on a Friday night.
It makes sense. You can't be an elite athlete and just be getting steaming all the time. It makes a lot of sense. I don't know if we've stumbled onto something new here.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure this is well established. This is a hot take. But you always hear like athletes being absolute animals on the session. Because they're all like testosterone up / steroided up and all that. You can see how that lends itself to the party, but you would also see how clean living and like being semi-Buddhist, like not on the session, is also much better for your longevity as a player. So
I think culturally, probably less fun though. Culturally, it's a bit more difficult for the English lads, I reckon.
Yeah, definitely.
It's got to be in it. Do you know what I mean? You know what I mean? Growing up and just being like, you know, players like Phil Foden, Jack Grealish, you can imagine they love going out on a Friday night, Friday, Saturday night, and having a few drinks. They have to, innit? Surely.
Or you go to the boxing or a nightclub if you feel folded and your mom starts a fight on two lads and then two other people come and back up the situation, nearly kill someone with a fire extinguisher.
Yeah, that was shocking. Like, literally, could have took the geezer's head off, man.
Yeah, but like, that was even a few weeks ago, wasn't it? I remember just thinking, what a nightmare situation. You can't even just go out for a few drinks, like... So what, you're just going to be getting a... Yeah, yeah, with your mom. Like, she started the fight. She started the fucking fight. Oh, it's not worth it, is it?
Proper born and bred Manc breaders, isn't it? Like, they just love the ag. Absolutely love the ag. Let's talk about the boys, though. England squad. Who's in? Who's out? Should we care? Friendlies this month. I think there's some notable omissions. Obviously, Marcus Rashford being one of them. So, you know, obviously his form this, you know, over the last 12 months, he's been criticized by certain people perhaps he's been putting too much focus on, you know, social issues, issues outside of the game. Should he be focusing more on his football? Obviously, a lot of people have intonated that that is the case, but he's not there. Tammy Abraham gets in. Foden and Grealish, who we just spoke about, getting Harry Kane, Bukayo Saka and Emile Smith-Rowe, the two Arsenal attacking duos. They've got in. Raheem Sterling's there. Jude Bellingham, obviously Conor Gallagher, who's been brought up. I think he's had a great season. He scored a few goals for Crystal Palace. Jordan Henderson's played well this year. He gets in. Mason Mount, Declan Rice, James Ward-Prowse. And then defensively, Mark Guehi gets his first call-up. Harry Maguire's still there. He hasn't quite been dropped due to bad performance. And I think Aaron Ramsdale in goal, I think he's going to be our number one going forward, man. Like, I slagged him. I've said £50 million is way too much for an English goalkeeper. But I think he's been fantastic for Arsenal over the last sort of 12 months.
Strong Arsenal presence in that squad. Liking the look of that, man. Especially for Saka as well, after all that bullshit with the penalties and all that, and all the well, to be fair, it wasn't like Beckham back in the day. They weren't like hanging dolls of him from trees and that, and like burning effigies of him in pub car parks. He got quite a lot of sympathy, I thought, like quite a lot of compassion from the England fans. I think, bearing in mind his age and the situation of the game and all that, Bonucci took his head off on the halfway line and he got a yellow card and all that stuff. So, yeah, man, liking that. Like Smith Rowe, Ramsdale, gotta say. That, especially from the midfield up, that looks like a pretty strong squad, man. You know, pretty strong. I mean, is it Guay who plays for Palace as well?
Yeah.
The centre-back who's coming in. What do you make of him in general?
I think he was cracking in the Championship. I haven't seen that much of him this year in the Premier League. But if the form he showed, I think when he was at Swansea, a very, very good player, reads the game really well. Still obviously young for a centre-back. But I think he's going to be a good addition to that squad. Glad he's got in there. Connor Cody as well, Wolves. He's been in a few squads now, but he hasn't really been sort of like that that important in the squad yet. Ben White, who you know, I think obviously at Arsenal, he's had a good season so far. I would like to see him get some game time in these friendlies, and perhaps, you know, moving forward, could he creep into the team, especially if they're going to play three centre backs, you know. How much time does Harry Maguire get to set his sort of, set his things in order? He needs to get back into form. So, you know, I think looking at that, Ben White, I'd like to see Ben White in there. Harry Maguire's probably going to start. Obviously, you got Trent Alexander-Arnold, the best right back in the world at the minute, I would say. Luke Shaw, hasn't been picked for United over the last few months, has he? I think Alex Telles has been playing a left back for them for quite a few weeks. I'm not sure if he's been injured or what, but he definitely hasn't been getting into the team. Obviously, no place for Aaron Wan-Bissaka as well. So there's quite a lot of Man United players that have been sort of left by the wayside in this squad. And we've only got perhaps this one with the friendlies, and then maybe I think one more squad before the final squad's decided in sort of November time, I guess it will be, before the World Cup. So he's obviously testing a few things out, is Southgate.
Which of these players would you cut from the squad? And why is it Harry Maguire?
Oh, you would? You'd have to think so, wouldn't you? No, I think we're giving the benefit of the doubt, man. I think, you know, everyone's been killing Harry Maguire. And, like, I think the comments regarding him are getting a bit out of hand. I don't think he's, like, the worst pound-for-pound signing in Man United history.
We shit on him weekly.
But if you watch some of his highlight reels of, like, him doing terrible things on Twitter... You can go and find it on our Twitter page as well. I retweeted it like last week. It's pretty joked. I was actually laughing out loud at some points of it. So yeah, I think he has been he's got away with it really. I think with this squad, I think that would have been too much of a dent to his confidence though. I think dropping him from the England squad after all the sort of criticism he's taken from Man United fans, I think it would be just a bit too much. I think give him this. Let's see if he can get back into some kind of form, because he was brilliant, I thought, in the Euros. I don't think you can criticise him for England in the Euros. So I think he deserves a chance to see if he can perform for England, even though it's going to be in friendlies. It's difficult to gauge, you know, how much of that competitive element seeps into friendlies, because I don't think really players, you know, go that hard in friendlies. Obviously, Mark Guehi, it's going to be a chance to him to impress, because he's not going to get much time. Maybe he gets a full game, maybe gets half a game, who knows? But Be interesting to see.
I think Harry Maguire definitely deserves the benefit of the doubt because of what he did last summer. And I think Luke Shaw deserves similar consideration for the same reason. How lethal was that hookup between him and Sterling last year, man? It was them just opening up all the teams and serving Harry Kane up, giving him like 9 chances. He'd scored 2 of them. Do you know what I mean? So I think, did you say Shaw had been included in the squad?
Yeah, yeah. And obviously scored in the final as well. So I think he's been picked.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Forgot
he's
about
been
that,
picked
yeah.
solely. He's been picked solely on his previous England form, I think, because I don't think really over the last 2 months, I'm just going to double check it now. I don't really think he's been featuring much for United. He's not been featuring that much as well. He had a couple of 90-minute games there. Where's he?
Sounds like he's playing pretty regular, mate.
Yeah. He's played every game for the last
mainstay.
Hasn't missed a game since the Euros.
He's had Corona. That's why.
Oh, there you go. The classic.
He's had the Corona from... Well, he's missed the last couple of games due to coronavirus.
He's probably double vaxxed, isn't he? So he's had the worst Corona ever. Like, 100%.
Yeah, he hasn't played full 90 minutes for a month. So he's missed the last sort of 3 games. Apart from that, he has been in the squad. So take away everything I've just said about Luke Shaw. He has been, he had sort of an injury. Yeah, he's been sort of niggling injuries. He had head injuries in November, December. Then he had a hamstring injury. So, and then he had coronavirus. So he's kind of been out of the team due to injury rather than poor performance.
Yeah, pint-related injuries, definitely. Isn't it?
Yeah, he's always had that kind of stigma attached to him that he's been carrying a bit too much weight. He's one of them. I just reckon he likes 8 pints after a game. Do you know what I mean?
Who can blame him? You got to rehydrate, ain't you?
Come on. Well, we'll move on to the 5 things, shall we? Number one, Naomi Osaka was reduced to tears following her round of 64 defeat to Veronika Kudermetova at the BNP Paribas Open at Indian Wells after being heckled by a spectator. It drew comparisons to the racist abuse that the Williams sisters suffered at the venue back in 2001, which caused them to boycott the tournament for over a decade.
Yeah, this piqued my interest. And Osaka referenced the incident concerning the Williams sisters in her post-match interview. And she said that the footage of the sisters getting heckled at that venue had been replaying itself in her head. She said she'd been heckled before whilst playing and it didn't bother her, but this evidently did. I actually went and had a look at that Indian Wells footage from 20 years ago and scrolled through an article on scroll.in from 2020. And it is quite unusual to see that kind of harsh booing at a tennis event. The article also pointed to the perceived match fixing by Richard Williams, the Williams sisters' father and coach, in the form of pulling Venus from the semi-final, in which she was scheduled to face Serena under the guise that she'd suffered a knee injury. So even though this has been presented or inferred or implied that there was a massive racial element that the Williams sisters suffered at Indian Wells and that link to Naomi Osaka, I don't think that that's as big of a factor as people think it is. Maybe it was a little bit, but I think that the crowd back in the day were just screwing because they perceived that Richard Williams was fixing the situation for his daughters rather than being a racial.
Obviously, he
thing.
Was the coach of both of them, and they met in the semi final, and then he basically got one of them to feign an injury to go through. Maybe she was carrying an injury. You know, you can't really verify that. I think the booing to both of them, maybe it's been perceived as being like predominantly racist. There was one incident where a guy was saying something very, very racist to her, something like, you know, I can't remember exactly what it was, but he was basically using her race as an offensive term. So yeah, I think there was a little bit of that, but the whole on the general was probably towards as what you just alluded to.
Yeah, you know, as well, the imagery of that event, that incident, was quite racially charged anyway, because Richard Williams himself, in response to the booing, raised his fist in a replica of that night. Was it the 1960s long jumpers who did, so I think it was the Mexico Olympics or back in the day, with the black gloves, like this is a black solidarity gesture, a well-recognized one within sports. And he replicated that whilst he was going into the private box. So it was visually, it's quite racially charged. Audibly, it's quite racially charged. But you would be forgiven for thinking it was all about race if you didn't know the context of the situation.
And what's the situation with the with Naomi Osaka? What was the situation with the heckling there? Was this a grey area too, like that? Or was that just clear-cut racist heckling?
I thought she was making that connection myself. And who's to say that she didn't feel it was to do with race? I can't speak for her. I don't know what she was feeling. I don't know if she heard something or seen something that would trigger that in her mind. For her to say that footage kept replaying itself in her mind suggested to me that she's still on shaky ground in terms of her own mental well-being. You know, she's been through a lot of shit in the past year or so. You can't blame her for imagining that's happening again, given the parallels between each incident. So it's a shame that it's affected her like that. And it's a shame that she's playing nowhere near her best either. I hope she finds herself in a better mental and emotional state going forward, because she's only a young girl. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's more important things in tennis.
Imagine going out to watch some tennis and shout at like a teenage girl.
Yeah, tennis doesn't strike me as one of those games that has that kind of, you know, that tribal attitude from the crowd in it. Do you know what I mean?
When you put it like that, it's bizarre, isn't it? It's fucking bizarre. Go out on a Saturday afternoon, sit down and just abuse teenagers for a bit in front of the world. That was a fucking ace, you piece of shit. It's not the right setting, is it, man?
Well, we'll move on to number two. Barnsley's Callum Stiles has been called up to the Hungarian national team. The midfielder, who was born and raised in Bury, joins a slew of other footballers that have recently dug out their grandparents' birth certificate to become part of a country's international setup. You remember we spoke about Matty Cash a while ago, featuring for Poland, and Ben Brereton adding the Diaz to his name, which dramatically turned him into an actually good footballer. He now represents Chile. So, Flynn, you could probably turn out for Spain because you've been living there long enough, haven't you? And I don't know about me and Jim. You got any obscure nationalities in your family tree, Jim?
I'm scared to, like, what is it called? 83 and me. What's it called? That thing we... 23 and me. I don't want to know about all the obscure nationalities I've got lurking in my DNA. I've already got, like, three that I know about. And that's quite enough. I'm already conflicted enough as it is, you know what I mean? But, yeah, I think I could only play for Ireland, Northern Ireland, and England, you know. So probably go for the North, innit, just for the niche one. What about you, Flynn? You're the same. You're the same makeup.
I could maybe play for Spain. I don't know if they'd have me. We'd see. We'd have to see about that. But yeah, I'd be the same as you. I'd be the England, Ireland, Northern Ireland, I think.
Yeah,
I
got Liam Flynn Pereira. Yeah, Liam Flynn Pereira starts at left back, definitely.
Yeah, you'd have to add something on the name at the end of your name, and it Liam Flynn Fernandez.
Oh, he's up Flynn Fernandez, unbelievable. Only started playing at the age of 31.
Yeah, mate, his first appearance in a Spanish fourth division at the age of 31, and now he's playing for the Spanish national team.
Into the stratosphere of international football from an extra syllable at the end of your name. It's unreal, isn't it? But
Flynn.
Okay. Liam Flynn Pereira at left back, man. Fuck, you know. All right. Number three, and the great Manny Pacquiao. His son has just won his first amateur bout last weekend with a unanimous decision over Andres Rosales, which is definitely a future pub quiz answer if this kid goes anywhere. He's 21 already, which is a bit late to start if he's got any big ideas in the sport. I mean, he should probably add a Spanish hyphen to the end of his name, probably get like straight up to world title fights immediately. And I imagine his dad, who is basically a walking deity in the Philippines, will loom rather large over this kid's entire career. But I wish him all the best. And if he does turn pro, he will definitely get that big push. The same as Muhammad Ali's grandson, who did a similar thing. Actually, now that I think about it, he just put Ali at the end of his name and to get that push and did a few shuffles in a few four-rounders. So we'll see where that one goes. And we'll stick in the world of combat sports for number four. And I think it's safe to say that our coverage of Jake Paul has fallen off over the past few months, being that he was the unofficial mascot for a little while. But he carries on poking away at roid raging Dana White. And he had an interesting business proposal for him. He said in the middle of their back and forth Twitter beef that he wants to face Conor McGregor under the UFC banner on a one fight deal with the following wager at stake. He said, if I win, you agree to my UFC fighter pay and healthcare proposal. If I lose, I'll donate my entire purse to all UFC fighters who make less than $50,000 a fight, and I will never mention the UFC again. Deal? Question mark. So it's just, he's a genius, isn't he? He's an absolute genius. Like, you know, when someone like Dana White tries to dismiss someone as being stupid or irrelevant, or you try and run a company, kid, that kind of shit, the kind of stuff that he's been coming out with, you know, he's getting under his skin, man. There's no reason for Dana not to accept that challenge. I mean, unless there's problems on Conor McGregor's side in agreeing the deal. I mean, Dana White's saying, like, oh, why are you fighting him? Like, you're too big for him. He's too small for you. And Jake Paul came back with a belter. He's like, mate, Conor McGregor has fought at 170 twice in the past. He's like, I've been fighting at 180 something. I'll make 175 and let's get this done. There's no reason why the fight can't happen. I said in the group, didn't I? I think this fight is definitely going to happen, 100%. It will be the biggest. It will surpass the Conor McGregor Mayweather circus for sure. I'm pretty sure this is going to happen, man.
First off, I can hear Tino's blood boiling from here. Are you calling Jake Paul a genius? I think this for me, it opens up a can of worms, man. Like, because is there a potential for match fixing there, though? You know what I mean? And
always, you know, there's always a potential for match fixing.
Yeah, especially when it comes to combat sports.
That's what I'm saying. Bread and butter, mate.
But yeah, as you say, that'd be a huge fight, and it would generate interest outside of the sports massively, wouldn't it? Really, two huge figures, and you know, I can only imagine how much money those two would make out of that. So there's not many negatives for Jake Paul at the minute. I think the way he's handling himself and all these sort of proposition he's making, the geezer can't lose at the minute.
Yeah, he's on a roll, man. He's on a definite roll. Imagine if he won. That'd be crazy.
I can see the fight happening, but I can't see it happening under those terms. Not in 10 billion years would Dana agree to that. Look what he's actually proposing. He's like, here's what's for stake. All right, if I lose, I'm going to give away my purse for one fight. If you lose, you're going to fuck up your whole business plan for the rest of its existence. Yeah. No one's agreeing to that.
I'm not sure if it makes sense in terms of McGregor's reputation as well, because if he did lose, he would just be a meme then forever. He, you know, if he seriously wants to get himself back into consideration and, you know, respected in the UFC again, he needs to take like a good fight in his division. Obviously, I don't think he's going to get Oliveira. Maybe he does. I don't know. I don't know what sort of Dana White's got in mind for McGregor, but he would need to beat somebody that's in contention to be able to be respected again, because he hasn't won a fight in what? When's the last time he won a fight? 5 years ago.
No, since we were in Barca, man, he fought Cowboy Cerrone.
Yeah, that was it. All right, Cerrone. Yeah. So one fight. Like, one win in 5 years? Then he's got a couple of losses to Poirier in there, hasn't he? Who else has he lost to since then?
He lost to Khabib.
It was
as well.
Yeah. So, I don't know, man. He needs to beat somebody like respectable, really, if he seriously wants to get considered again in that division. So I'm not sure. If he takes his fight, then maybe that's his sort of like his competitive career over, and this would sort of be like, right, now go and make some more money kind of thing.
He's been a caricature for a good while now. And I think you saw that the game, the mixed martial arts game, if it hasn't surpassed him entirely, it's definitely at the point now where, because he's an older man and heavier and he's adapted a less elusive, inventive style, that he's more manageable as a fighter, especially at 155 for these other guys, you know, who have been developing their skills in his absence. So, yeah, I don't think he's half the threat he was when he first came onto the scene as a 145-pounder, completely unpredictable, you know, knockout power. Just, you know, just a fucking nightmare to deal with, like, even to wrestlers who, like, yeah. So I get what you're saying. And I think this is something like this would help him stay more relevant. You know, he can lay claim to getting rid of, like, someone like Jake Paul, who's been tormenting combat sports athletes for the better part of 2 or 3 years. So it's definitely an interesting proposition. And I think the money that can be made from a fight like this I think will be enticing to anyone, including Dana White. So we'll see. Well, we'll definitely be watching that. I think that fight is going to happen, but we'll see.
I 100% agree with you. That lightweight division's moved on like light years since it's been gone. He was already not that good when he had that injury. He wasn't really deserving of his ranking, I'd say. Thing is, though, he probably still could knock anyone out first round if he connects. And he's always been good at that. But yeah, they're too good for him now. Gage, he's too good for him. Poirier, we know he's too good for him. Makhachev, too good for him. Oliveira, too good for him. He ain't got a chance in that division. The only chance he's got is more circus fights like this.
See, I think Gage is probably the only fight stylistically that suits him, because Gage, even though he's like an NCAA wrestler, he refuses to wrestle.
He'll stand up with him.
Yeah, he'll stand up. I think even Michael Chandler would try and take him down, you know, and he's all about the fucking gladiator fights, isn't it? I think everyone else you've just named there would just strangle him. So, yeah, it's a shame, man. Remember that McGregor magic back in the day? It was so amazing. Cool. It was so sick for like 3 or 4 years, man. I'm feeling sad now. Let's move on, man.
All right, we'll quickly smash out number 5 and then we'll move on to the featured fights. So Tampa Bay Bucks odds to win the Super Bowl next year have been slashed dramatically after the GOAT Tom Brady announced he was just trolling everyone when he said he was going to retire. And on the weekend, he was in Manchester with his family to see a fellow GOAT perform at Old Trafford and was afforded the hospitality of the Glazers themselves, along with the great Sir Alex Ferguson in attendance. Being around all that greatness clearly ignited the juices and he fancies another crack at it. Fair play to him. I do feel sorry for the unlucky fan who bought his final touchdown at an auction for $500,000, though. It must be left feeling a little deflated.
I think he'd be all right, you know, if you can spend $500,000 on a fucking football. I think you're all right, mate. Well done for that pun, by the way. Don't think I didn't catch that. Oh, there's another pun for you. Don't worry about it, mate.
And $500,000 for some pigskin and some air. Oh, absolutely terrible, man. I do feel...
What do you call it? Hand egg ball.
Hand egg ball, yeah. Hand egg. but you know, it is what it is, and he's going to come back 45 and he's still going to win a Super Bowl. That's what's going to happen. Everyone's just going to be crying, man. Everyone's going to be in absolute. If he does that, if he comes back now and wins the Super Bowl, is he the best sports person of all time?
I think it's probably that conversation with Sir Alex Ferguson that you can attribute his greatness to, rubbing against a real god. You know what I mean?
That's where he gets the spice melange.
Spice. He knows about the spice melange.
We'll move on to the featured fights for this week and a retrospective from ONE Championship. I think it was last Thursday. Gary Tonin failing in his bid for the ONE featherweight title, suffering a first round KO by Than Lee, the defending champion, while hunting for a heel hook. Now, Lee trains under another MMA leg lock specialist, Ryan Hall, and he was perfectly poised to counter Tonin's attempts, and his vicious punches from the top position shut the challenger's lights out. It's... pretty disturbing stuff. If you ever get to catch the replay, as was John Lineker's bludgeoning win over longtime champion Bibiano Fernandez. Some of the widest hooks and uppercuts you're likely to see. Onto becoming the bantamweight champ. Yeah, he had to overcome an early knockdown there, regaining his feet from several takedowns and finding the stoppage in the second round. Over in the UFC, former John Jones victim Thiago Santos suffered his fourth loss in 5 fights, dropping a decision to Magomed Ankalaev in the main event of UFC Fight Night 203. I seen an interesting stat about the records of fighters after they fight John Jones, and it's harrowing reading in terms of, it looks like he just ruins people. Like, he just ruins their careers. So,
and then ruins his own career.
Oh, yeah, but yeah, he's the master at that, isn't he? I think the amount of damage he's done to his own career pales in insignificant... Oh, the amount of damage he's done to other fighters pales in insignificance to what he's done to himself. In Bellator, Adam Borix solidified his position as one of the company's best featherweights with a decision win over Mads Bernal in a very entertaining main event from their 276 show. But the most exciting event from last weekend was, of course, Lee Wood defending his WBA featherweight title against Michael Conlan in Nottingham with a 12-round KO after trailing on all 3 cards. Conlan was only up by a point on 2 of the cards and 2 points on the other. I don't want to speculate because it didn't go that far, but that fight, if it went to the judges' scorecards, had a real chance of becoming another Taylor Catterall shit show. And I think Wood's very fortunate in a lot of senses that he managed to pull the victory out in the last round. For me, I scored the fight 106-101 to Conlon going into the final round. I gave Wood only the 8th and the 11th with the knockdown. But overall, Conlon was well on top for most of the night. I don't know if Conlon and his trainer, Adam Booth, worked on this beforehand, but from the first round, Conlon exposed and began to exploit a serious deficiency in Wood's defense, something that Amir Khan has always been guilty of, which is dropping his backhand to parry body shots. So Conlon, he's a southpaw, he's a left-handed fighter. He launched a few backhands to the body from his southpaw stance, and he watched Wood drop his backhand while he was pulling away. Now, he threw that shot 3 or 4 times, and then bang, he just hurled one over the top with about 15 seconds to go in the first round, and Wood hit the canvas like a sack of shit. He looked like he was out cold, and I don't know how he got up from that. I don't know how he made it back from his corner. I don't know how he came out for the next round, and I would guess if that knockdown, bearing in mind how heavy it was, happened any earlier, Conlon would have got the stoppage in round one, which is a result no one would have envisaged. So, to be fair, I don't think Wood recovered for another 4 or 5 rounds. Conlon kept landing that left hand to the chin. He was working his body, slugging it out at times, perhaps when he didn't really need to. And Wood, just like his Nottingham compatriot, Carl Froch, he just carried on walking him down, taking punishment. And it wasn't until the 8th round of taking clean punches when he landed some good body shots underneath Conlon's left elbow while he was in a cross-arm defense and ducking and diving. And that was the first time he made any serious headway in the fight. Conlon even took control back in the 9th, getting on the jab for the first time all night, but Wood kept pushing him to the ropes, forcing him more and more into his shell. He had no real joy until the 11th when he scored the knockdown. And that, even then, a lot of people thought that was a slip. So even in the 12th, with 90 seconds to go in a fight I knew the result of, the finish still came unexpectedly for me. Wood rushed Conlon to the ropes where a right hand just ripped the soul out of him and sent his body backwards out of the ring, word to Bernard Hopkins. It was a very unusual ending. Conlon looked like he was nowhere near being finished before that final punch landed, and all of a sudden, he's unconscious and tumbling through the ropes. It was a great fight overall. Conlon put on some show. He was cunning, he was confident, and he was willing to push for the knockout, even if that wasn't in his best interest or wasn't the most sensible thing to do. Wood showed unbelievable toughness and determination. I think he was boxing on instinct for half the fight at least, and he managed to scratch and claw his way back in and like hold onto his belt. You know, it's unbelievable performance from both men. And this thought occurred to me the other day in terms of Lee Wood's trainer, Ben Davison. I was thinking he's had some pretty high-profile underperformances as a coach. A lot of people don't like this guy. I actually quite like him. I think he's an intelligent coach. But I think this and previous results demonstrate one major deficiency in him. I think he doesn't prepare his fighters well for southpaws, because Lee Wood is fighting Conlon, who's a southpaw, looks terrible and basically manned his way back into the fight. Jack Catterall is a southpaw. Josh Taylor put in his worst performance in years in that fight. And then you got to think back to the last time the Lord God and Savior Tyson Fury looked anywhere near human. And that was against Otto Wallin. And he was a southpaw. So I think there's a problem there. I don't know if it's the way he prepares people. I don't know tactically the way he sets up, how their stance, how their posture, their positioning is developing under his tutelage. I think there's an issue there. I won't get on that bandwagon. I think Davison's a decent trainer. I know he lets his mouth run away with him sometimes, but I think there is a problem in that area. And I'm just sad I didn't get to watch that fight live because it looked pretty unbelievable. And yeah, the excitement was gone. I knew it was going to happen, even if I was still surprised in the 12th round. So we'll look ahead to this weekend's fights. And the UFC's back in the UK for the first time since 2019 when Jorge Masvidal knocked out Darren Till. Word to Street Jesus. Tom Aspinall, he'll fight Alexander Volkov, a Russian athlete who is not being penalised, interestingly, and fairly for his country's involvement in this conflict. So I hope he still gets to go ahead. Arnold Allen versus Dan Hooker at featherweight, and Paddy Pimblett versus Kazula Vargas. Now, Aspinall and Allen are both pushing for certified top 10 / top 5 status now. Pimblett is just at the beginning of his UFC journey, so I feel like the results will reflect that, but we'll see. We could be in for a shock either way. I think Arnold Allen will definitely beat Dan Hooker. I think the timing's right for that one, but we'll see. And ONE Championship aren't back until March 26th with their monster 1X card. That's going to be like their WrestleMania, to put it in perspective for Bissett. Bellator aren't back until April. As for the boxing, Crusher of Dreams, David Avanesian, defends his European welterweight title against Askari Metz at the Wembley Arena. Sonny Edwards defends his IBF flyweight title against Mohamed Wasim in Dubai. Former light welterweight champion and former Josh Taylor opponent Regis Progre will also feature on that undercard against Tyrone McKenna. And I'm hoping these aren't on at the same time, because I like all of these fights. They're very, I thought we were going to get away by saying, well, without saying this, they're very unsexy fights. You know what I mean? But they're trade fights, and Sonny Edwards, he's a low-key, like, soon to be an elite fighter. So looking forward to all of those, and I'll be taking over the TV for a good 7 hours plus if they manage to sit side by side together. So definitely a good weekend coming up.
Yeah, because you was in Edinburgh, wasn't you, over the weekend? That's probably why you didn't catch the Conlon Wood fight live. Obviously, you're disappointed you didn't see it live. But did you, even getting the feeling from the highlights, I think Eddie Hearn came out and said it was like one of the most remarkable fights he's ever seen. We've already had a couple of fights this year that have been the sort of like the comebacks. You know, the real big comeback fights of the year. We had one last month on the undercard of the... Which fight was it? There was an undercard, a British fighter. He was up against a Polish lad, was it? And he looked like he was losing that fight and managed
Jordan
to
pull. Gill.
That was the one, Jordan Gill, yeah.
He was fighting... I think that guy was Italian or Spanish. Mm-hmm. And he had both his eardrums burst. And he stood in the corner and got the knockout.
Mental. That was it. He could barely stand at the end of the fight. Yeah.
Yeah. He was celebrating and falling all over the place. He looked like he'd been on the session with Luke Shaw. So, yeah, there's been that Lee Wood performance was remarkable.
Amazing.
He was taking some serious stick. I mean, look, anyone who's ever been punched in the face knows it's not a very pleasant experience. When you're getting punched in the face for the better part of 36 minutes and you manage to overcome that and work your way millimeter by millimeter towards victory, where there seems to be absolutely no chance that you're going to achieve that win, and still keep your head and still keep plugging away and still absorb punishment. He deserves a lot of credit for that, man. I mean, it wasn't even for like the top band of world championships. I hope they do get the rematch on, to be honest. I think it's the best fight to make, the most enticing fight to make, certainly the most exciting one to make. But I think Conlon would win that rematch.
Run it back, yeah.
I'm glad you said he deserves some credit, because all I hear about this fight, and I did watch it, and all I hear about it is that he was lucky to get this knockout. And look, maybe I was looking at it in a different way, because I'd already seen the knockout and I knew the outcome. When I watched the match, I saw a man with way better cardio against the scrappier fighter. The scrappier fighter was winning for most of it, but when that knockdown came in the 11th, that was it. That was it. Conlon was gassed, and you could see it. And Wood looked a fair bit fresher at that point. I saw a more conditioned fighter get the knockout that he deserved, I think.
That's interesting you say that, because a lot of people have said that Conlon, after knocking Wood down in the first and knocking him down so heavily, he really upped his tempo through rounds 2, 3, and 4. And
that,
he never quite recovered. He never got his gas tank back, like filled it back up. That's going to be a real issue for him. And if that maintains over his career. But I also think that the body shots that Wood landed in round 8, especially, they didn't look like they were landing, but they were sickening shots, man. And I think they couldn't help but have a detrimental effect on his cardio. But I also think that Conlon could have boxed at distance more intelligently and exerted himself far less. I think he'll stay on that jab and stay on his bike if these two get it together again. And I think he'll walk the fight if he fights like that, to be honest.
And I think call it what you like, but I cannot call sending another man into the abyss lucky. Like, do you know what I mean? I couldn't envision calling it lucky. At the end of the day, you still got a bloke in front of you that's been pounding you, as you say, for the better part of 36 minutes. And to be able to pull out that knockout the way he did, nah, man, there's nothing lucky about it, is it? It's just, as you say, it's pure. He had enough left in the tank to be able to deliver that knockout blow. And, you know, sent him to the Balrog. Not even Gandalf could fucking save him. That's harsh, because it was troubling. It was troubling watching it back. Like, I think everyone was worried for him. Even Lee Wood in the ring was, he was telling the crowd to sort of like, you know, just turn it down for a minute, until we know that he's okay. And, you know, thankfully he was. And I think he took it really well, Colin, didn't he, to be fair?
No, he did. He was like saying, like, that was some punch he caught me with, like, nothing but respect for him. It was like, I want to run it back. But, you know, the post-fight chat between both camps has been very complimentary. I wonder if they'll get the direct rematch on, especially since Josh Warrington is about to fight Kiko Martinez for that, I think it's for the IBF title that he vacated a couple of years ago before he got knocked out by that young Mexican kid. Their rematch obviously ended in like a technical draw because one of them got a cut in the fourth round.
Lara. Yeah, that was unfortunate because I think that was a really sort of anticipated fight, and hopefully they run that back as well.
Nah, they ain't going to run shit back, man.
That's unfortunate for Lara, man.
Yeah, that rematch was heating up as well. It was definitely heating up. But Lara scored a knockout, I think it was a week or two ago, on the undercard of a Showtime card, I think. So he's still getting exposure, but yeah, he should be champion by now. And I think that, you know, the promoters, the way they're thinking, they want to get as much money as possible, especially if they're, you know, Josh Warrington and Lee Wood are under the same promoter, aren't they? So if you've got Lee Wood from Nottingham and you've got Josh Warrington, who's already sold out Elland Road, a football stadium, you've got massive cross-sport interest there in like a Northern Derby. Really, that's a big moneymaker. That's a stadium fight. So that's the way they're going. They're going to want Warrington to beat Kiko Martinez. They should let Lee Wood have a bit of a rest, because that will take years off your life, a fight like that. So hopefully he recovers well. And yeah, hopefully Conlon doesn't get left out in the cold, because that was it was a stellar performance in his first world championship appearance. And if he improves from here, he'll definitely get a title around his waist before he retires.
I want to hear some hot takes about UFC London. Aspinall Volkov, what are we saying?
Ooh,
I like Aspinall a lot, man. The guy's humble. He's not saying, I want to get that belt straight away. I've seen interviews with him. He's like, nah, I'm new. I want to fight my way up a bit more. I like his vibes. So I'm rooting for him this week.
I seen an interview with him, or read an interview, sorry, that he's saying he credits Tyson Fury with his whole outlook on fighting just improving. He said 5 years ago, he was in camp with Fury, helping him prepare for, I think it might have been Klitschko. And he was saying just being around him and just seeing his mentality and how he approached fighting, he's like, it inspired me to take my career seriously. He's like, and he applied that to Volkov. He's like, this guy has been in the top 10 for how many years? Look how many wins he's got. Look how many knockouts he's got. I'm just a young kid coming through, as you say. And like, I could feel that he was channeling that underdog mentality that Fury would have taken into the Klitschko fight. I haven't seen enough of Aspinall, you know, to make a good pick about this. But I know Volkov is like 6'7" kickboxer. He's got legs like tree trunks. I think only the very best tend to beat him. So if Aspinall can make a statement against him, that will be him going into the top five, pretty much.
When was the last British heavyweight champ of the UFC? Has there ever been one?
Nah. I don't think there's ever been one.
This could be the dude.
This could be the guy, man. Yeah, for sure. But he's not an overly big heavyweight either. You know, I think he's like, I don't know about getting down to light heavy, but, you know, he could definitely shred down a little bit. Fighters like Gane and Ngannou, they're just like monsters compared to him. Even Volkov will be.
Huge, yeah. Yeah, I saw the media face-off today. And he's a good few inches shorter than Volkov, but he's a big dude, though. He's a heavy dude.
Yeah, yeah.
He looked heavier, but he was a bit shorter.
And what about Paddy the Baddy? Does he need to get a victory on his card just to make sure that media attention comes back? Because he's kind of like, he's been falling by the wayside a little bit. He had that initial kind of like burst onto the scene. And obviously had those sort of like funny, quirky sort of like involvements with the media and stuff like that. But he's been relatively unspoken of in the last few months. Do you reckon he needs this victory really to put himself into contention?
Oh, yeah. If you've got the hype, you need to keep it going with wins, man. And he's been back on the radar as well. Did you see he nearly got into a fight in like a hotel lobby or something with his, I think it was either his upcoming opponent or some other random Spanish guy like that. And he had
Georgian. He said some shit about Georgia a year ago on Twitter. And this guy's like, how dare you disrespect Georgia?
Yeah, yeah.
And who has anything to say about Georgia? Like the country? Like, I don't know anything about Georgia apart from their capital. Like, literally.
I don't imagine Paddy Pimblett's that well read either. That Georgian, you fucking fannies, mate. It's like, he's saying, you think I'm going to shit myself? He's like, from all of you. He's like, I don't give a shit, man. He's like, cool. It's comical stuff, man. Good promotion for him. Obviously, nothing was going to kick off with the camera there. I think Paddy Pimblett's probably onto a winner. Who knows where he's going? He's good. He's a good media presence for us so far. You're only going to know where he's at once he starts fighting top 15, top 12 opponents, man. It's a bit early to anticipate his trajectory just yet. But I think Arnold Allen will smash the daylights out of Dan Hooker. Definitely.
Go on, the Allen namesake as well. Allen horses have been winning this week at Cheltenham. Now we want the Allen fighters to win.
But is if I remember correctly, he trains with Firas Sahabi, which is GSP's old coach. And I think he's on a mad run. I think he's on like he's 11-1 or something off the top of my head. I won't look it up because we're pressing on for time. But yeah, he's looking like the most viable future champion out of the three of the British fighters that are on the main card. So,
is that featherweight they're fighting at now?
That's it, yeah. Dan Hooker's moved down for the first time in God knows how many years.
After he got dealt with by Makhachev.
He's been getting dealt with like standard, but like Marco Chandler done him in the first round as well. So I always pause for concern over older fighters who look to move down weight classes in an attempt to reinvent themselves because it rarely ends well. Rarely.
You can't take that, especially in the later years. It's already put your body through a lot cutting weight. Now cutting another division down.
Yeah, it's not as if Dan Hooker's a small guy either. Like he spars Israel Adesanya and they're basically the same height. So I don't see what taking off. Or is it 155 down to 145? If Conor McGregor can't make 145, what's Dan Hooker playing at, man? I don't know.
Also, just wanted to mention as well, Jim, are you going to, maybe not this weekend or in the future, for the big boxing fights, you and Tino are probably going to have a sort of, you know, a Sunday post-fight analysis, sort of 10 to 15-minute videos. We're going to try and get those out on Instagram just so that we can have a reflection on the fight then and there, rather than having the sort of like week after kind of, it'd be nice to get you and Tino your opinions on the fight straight away. We can get your scorecards on there just to give the people interested in those fights sort of like a first hand review of the fight.
No, absolutely. And most Sundays, me and Tino are still drunk by midday from the night before, so it will be quite entertaining at the very least. It will be an excuse to get the hair of the dog that bit you on a Saturday. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to doing that, man, especially because we're so animated in dropping voice notes to each other and going in the group and saying what happened and what didn't, what we agree on, what we don't. We may as well air it out there for people. And it'll be something to reflect on in the following week's episode. So I'm proper looking forward to doing that.
Yeah, definitely. I think the Instagram followers that we do have, I think they'd love that. We have had sort of a following through this sort of feature fights and the boxing. So that'll be something to look forward to for our listeners. And that'll be it for this week. Once again, it is a pleasure, lads. Ace Ventura and Liam Flynn Fernandez. You know, great to speak to you again.
Nice one, boys.
Muchas gracias.
Liam Flynn Fernandez down the left-hand side, mate.
Liam Flynn Fernandez whips in.
A goal.
Fernandez.
Flynn Fernandez holds it.